KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. President Trump's budget, the first of his new term this hour, and several people who grew up under authoritarian regimes overseas, left and right, what their experiences tells them about America now. Fulya Pinarch from Turkey is now a professor in the U.S. and says,
I feel quite fragile because I feel like I can't work freely here. It just feels like I'm stuck, but I don't know what's going to happen at the end.
And later, the national security shakeup, NBA playoffs, Lakerless, and we walk the golden road. First, our newscast today is Saturday, May 3rd, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. This week saw mixed news on the U.S. economy. It shrank in the first 3 months of the year, and consumer confidence has fallen to the lowest level since the beginning of the pandemic. But there was encouraging news, unemployment. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
Employers added 177,000 jobs in April, not quite as many as the month before, but more than forecasters had expected. And the unemployment rate held steady at a low 4.2%. That suggests that even with all the tariff chaos of the recent weeks, employers are still hiring. Wages are also still going up. So with more people working and paychecks getting bigger, that should provide some juice to keep the economy moving forward.
NPR's Scott Horsley. Investor Warren Buffett brought up tariffs today at the start of the annual shareholder meeting of his company, Berkshire Hathaway. He said the U.S. shouldn't use trade as a weapon, but should be looking to trade with the rest of the world. Buffett said in his view, it's a big mistake when 7.5 billion people don't like you very well. The Justice Department is suing a handful of states over their efforts to hold fossil fuel companies accountable for damages from climate change. NPR's Michael Copley reports the government's lawsuits follow unsuccessful efforts by oil companies and Republican attorneys general to block climate litigation.
The Justice Department is suing New York and Vermont over laws that are aimed at holding fossil fuel companies responsible for damages from more extreme storms and heat waves. The department's also suing Hawaii and Michigan to stop them from suing fossil fuel companies for allegedly misleading the public about the dangers of burning fossil fuels. The Justice Department says climate pollution is a national and global issue, and that states are exceeding their authority. An environmental coalition called Make Polluters Pay says the Justice Department lawsuits are politically motivated. The Supreme Court has already refused to halt climate lawsuits filed against the fossil fuel industry by various states and localities. Michael Copley, NPR News.
Elon Musk has wanted to create his own city in Texas for years. Today he could get his wish. The Texas Newsroom's Lauren McGaughey has more.
Residents who live in and around SpaceX's rocket testing and launch facility near Brownsville will vote today on whether to incorporate the area as the new city of Starbase. According to a Texas Newsroom analysis of the voter rolls, most of the 283 eligible voters work for SpaceX. Musk himself is also on the list. Incorporating the city will give SpaceX more control over the development of this area in an unincorporated part of South Texas sandwiched between the border with Mexico and the Gulf. It could also mean more scrutiny and transparency for the company. If the vote passes, Musk also wants lawmakers to give him more control to close the public beach near the rocket launch site. I'm Lauren McGaughey at Starbase, Texas.
This is NPR News. Russia launched a major drone attack on the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv last night. The mayor said at least 46 people were injured when drones hit 12 locations in the city, including apartment buildings. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky denounced the strikes and urged Ukraine's allies to help it strengthen its air defenses. Kharkiv is located about 19 miles from the Russian border. The Kentucky Derby is this weekend. In the field of 19, many of their jockeys were born outside the U.S. NPR's Jimena Becio reports.
Junior Alvarado has won over 2,000 races in his career as a jockey. But since growing up in Venezuela, he had his sights on winning the Kentucky Derby.
My only chance so I can win that race, I have to go to the United States and I have to make it there.
On Saturday, he'll compete in the Derby for the sixth time. Alvarado entered the country on an athlete's visa called a P1 visa. He's now a U.S. citizen. And he's one of many jockeys who see their athlete's journey and immigration journey intertwined. The athletes hail from all over, primarily from Central and South America. Jockeys from Italy and France will also race. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, Louisville.
Music fans are gathering at Copacabana Beach in Brazil for a free concert by Lady Gaga tonight. Rio de Janeiro hosted the 2016 Olympics and has been holding large-scale free events to boost the local economy that has been struggling in recent years. Last year, Madonna's performance on the beach attracted 1.6 million people. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. President Trump has released his first budget of this term. It's a policy wish list of sorts that lays out how the government would spend money if he had his way. Of course, it's up to Congress to make the actual spending decisions. This budget comes after the president has already used executive orders and the cost-cutting effort known as the Department of Government Efficiency to try to make big changes to the federal government. NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben joins us. Danielle, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
What do you see standing out in this budget?
Well, first off, it would make some big cuts to non-defense spending. It would cut those by nearly one quarter. Now, that is a big category. It includes education, transportation, scientific research. So it's a deep and broad swath of cuts. And then in turn, there are some big spending additions. Trump wants to boost defense spending by 13% to $1 trillion per year. And not only that, but he's proposing a 65% boost to Homeland Security spending. And that would go in part to mass deportations and completing the border wall, his signature issues. I should add, though, that this is not a full budget. It's an outline, and it doesn't include mandatory spending. That's those big social safety net programs like Medicare and Medicaid. A more detailed full budget, that's coming in the coming months.
Tell us, please, more about those cuts to non-defense spending. Specifically what?
Well, Trump is proposing some really deep cuts to a few agencies. He proposes cuts of more than 50% at the Environmental Protection Agency and the National Science Foundation. He also proposes cuts at the Internal Revenue Service, NOAA. I mean, really, if it's an agency that doesn't do immigration or defense, there's a good chance that Trump wants to cut it. He also proposes some cuts to education, although the administration did take care to specify that they don't propose cutting Head Start funding.
Why does the administration want to cut spending at the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration or spending for scientific research?
Well, that's because there's a lot of culture war in this budget, and a lot of programs are argued against on those grounds. Now, in this short document, the phrase DEI, for example, shows up 31 times. Woke shows up 12 times, and so on. Cuts from NOAA are justified because of that agency's climate work. The budget says that some programs, quote, radicalize students against markets. So in that way, the budget is very Trumpy. But that said, there are some traditionally fiscal conservative moves in here. For example, the budget proposes moving a bunch of federal programs like rental assistance out of the federal government and to the state and local level. I talked to Jessica Riedel. She's a budget expert at the right-leaning Manhattan Institute. And as a fiscal conservative, she likes some parts of this budget, but she said the cuts should be going to deficit reduction, and instead, they're going toward defense.
There's no deficit reduction here. And if one accounts for the revenue losses from cutting IRS staff, one could argue that the net effect of this proposal would be to increase budget deficits.
Danielle, it's Congress that ultimately makes spending decisions. How much attention should we pay to this document?
You're right. This is just the starting point of a conversation with Congress, and presidents don't usually get to call the budget shots. But the fact that Trump keeps trying to cut spending on his own changes things. I talked to Brendan Duke at the left-leaning Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. Here's how he put it.
I certainly think that they're shooting with live ammo in a way with their budget in a way that is not true of most budgets, because they have shown their willingness to try to do these sorts of cuts without congressional sign-off.
There have been some court challenges to Trump's attempted cuts so far, but congressional Republicans, they haven't really pushed back on those moves. So this budget could be a roadmap for things to come from the Trump White House.
And NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben, thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
Countless people have left authoritarian countries for the promise of freedom and safety in the United States. Huddled masses yearning to breathe free, as it says in the poem on the Statue of Liberty. As NPR's Frank Langfitt reports, there are now reminders here in the U.S. for some of the regimes they fled.
David Karanyi is a political exile from Hungary who lives in New York. Last year, he attended his mother's 70th birthday back home, but instead of flying straight to Hungary, he flew to Austria.
I landed in Vienna, and I rented a car, and I went across the border, switched off my phone. I went through the border, and then I came back the next day.
Why the indirect route? Well, crossing the border by land, where there's no passport control, allowed Karanyi to slip in and out undetected by the Hungarian government.
I have had multiple warnings from friends, even embassies in Hungary, that told me that maybe it's better if I don't come back to Hungary anytime soon.
So Karanyi, he's also an American citizen, has been struck by how immigration officials have recently treated some people entering or re-entering the United States. In cases like this one at a Detroit airport, as covered by the local CBS station.
A Dearborn lawyer says that he was questioned by federal agents at DTW after a spring break trip, and he thinks this is likely the result of him representing a pro-Palestinian demonstrator.
The lawyer says the U.S. agents also asked to search through his phone.
I never in a million years would have imagined that that atmosphere of fear and that type of random searches at border crossings and looking into people's phones and looking for personal political opinions is something that I would live through in my life in the United States.
Karanyi says he watched Prime Minister Viktor Orban take control of the judiciary and news media in Hungary over many years. He says he's struck by how quickly Trump is changing the government here.
That's deeply disconcerting that we got to this stage in such a short period of time.
NPR asked the White House for comment on this story, but did not receive one. Before taking office, President Trump insisted he would not be an autocrat beyond Inauguration Day. Here he is in a Fox News town hall during last year's campaign.
I'm going to be a dictator for one day. We're going to do two things. The border, we're going to make it so tight you can't get in unless you come in legally. And the other is energy. We're going to drill, baby, drill. After that, I'm not going to be a dictator. After that, I'm not going to be a dictator.
Some immigrants from authoritarian countries say Trump's been true to his word. Lily Tong Williams is running for Congress in New Hampshire as a Republican. In fact, she says it's Democrats who most remind her of the authoritarian officials back in her homeland, China.
Who censored us during the COVID times? It was not Trump. Trump himself was censored. It was the DOJ under Biden, pressure Facebook, pressure Twitter to censor lots of people.
The Biden administration said it encouraged responsible action to protect public health.
I'm Fulya Pınar. I'm an anthropologist.
Pınar grew up in Turkey. She says she watched President Recep Tayyip Erdogan consolidate the news media and attack scholars. Pınar first came to the U.S. at 19. To work at a Six Flags water park in Illinois. She returned in 2016 for a PhD in intellectual freedom.
It was about survival as an academic, to be able to continue thinking, teaching, writing without fear.
Since taking office, Trump has withheld billions of dollars from universities he says haven't done enough to fight anti-Semitism. Now, Panarche, who's untenured, worries some students who disagree with her teachings could report her.
I'm teaching anthropologies of the Middle East, and I'm teaching it differently now.
Before, in her lectures, Panarche would cite death tolls for conflicts like the war in Gaza. Now, she directs students to readings where they can find the answers on their own. Panarche wants to protect herself from any charges of bias.
So I'm trying to be more careful. You know, at the end of the semester, students usually provide feedback about professors, and then your promotion depends on that.
Did you think before and even during your time in the United States, you'd ever have to do this?
No, I didn't see that coming, honestly. And this was actually the reason why I came to the United States.
So how do you feel about being in America now?
I feel quite fragile because I feel like I can't work freely here. It just feels like I'm stuck, but I don't know what's going to happen at the end.
In addition to taking on universities, the Trump administration has also targeted news organizations that cover the president critically. Under Chairman Brendan Carr, the Federal Communications Commission is investigating broadcasters, including ABC, CBS, and NBC, on allegations that they've favored Democrats. Here's Carr speaking with CNBC late last year.
The law is very clear. The Communications Act says you have to operate in the public interest, and if you don't, yes, one of the consequences is potentially losing your license. And of course, that's on the table. I mean, look, broadcast licenses are not sacred cows.
Filipina journalist Maria Ressa says that reminds her of something former President Rodrigo Duterte, another autocratic leader, did several years ago.
The largest network in the Philippines, a news group I managed for 6 years, the Duterte administration, they took away their franchise. This is like saying taking away the license to operate of the largest, most popular broadcast network in the United States.
Duterte left office in 2022 and is now awaiting trial in The Hague. But Ressa says he did lasting damage to the news media.
That network, even after the end of Duterte's reign, never got its license, its franchise back. What is damaged in this time period, what is destroyed, stays destroyed.
Ressa won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2021. She spent this semester teaching at Columbia University. Ressa, who's also a U.S. citizen, has a message for people here.
Americans are slow to respond, but I know what fear does. I lived through this in the Philippines. But I guess from our lessons, don't let fear paralyze you, because you are at your strongest now.
And Ressa says, every day Americans fail to act and defend their rights, they grow weaker. Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Australia held parliamentary elections today. The ruling Labour Party will remain in power. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is claiming a second term, the first Australian Prime Minister to win a consecutive term in 20 years. The Pakistani military says it successfully test-fired a ballistic missile today. The test comes amid rising tensions with India over the disputed Kashmir region, where at least 26 people were killed in an attack last month. And rain could complicate today's Kentucky Derby at Churchill Downs. There are 19 races in the horses in the race. 13 of them have never raced on a wet track. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, whose scientists work to lay the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, which are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Danafarber.org/everywhere. From FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at FJC.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. During his first term in office, President Trump went through a great many cabinet appointees, especially national security advisors. Little more than 100 days into his new term, the president's national security team is again in flux. NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie joins us. Greg, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be here, Scott.
Let's start with the latest. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz was removed, or should we say relocated, from his role. What was the stated reason? Where did he go?
So Trump plans to nominate Waltz to become the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Now, Vice President J.D. Vance tried to downplay any sense of turmoil. In an interview on Fox News, he said Waltz was being given a new position for which he seemed better suited.
The media wants to frame this as a firing. Donald Trump has fired a lot of people. He doesn't give them Senate-confirmed appointments afterwards.
So, still, Trump wouldn't be doing this if he wasn't unhappy with Waltz's performance in some way, and this UN job is seen as a bit of a consolation prize. Now, Waltz took responsibility for accidentally adding a journalist to that now infamous Signal group chat back in March, and that was probably one contributing factor to his move.
And yet, did he make the same misstep this week?
At Tuesday's cabinet meeting, a Reuters photographer was there. He took a photo sort of over the shoulder of Waltz, and it showed Waltz using Signal on his phone. And in addition to this, Waltz has had some policy positions that seem a bit out of sync with Trump. Before he joined Trump's team, he was very tough on Russia and supportive of Ukraine, in contrast to Trump. So this was probably a factor as well.
The president is replacing Waltz, at least temporarily, with Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who will also keep his job as Secretary of State. This is a lot of work, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the first thing Rubio is going to need to do is clone himself, because he's going to have to be in two places at once. The Secretary of State is in constant motion, traveling from one foreign capital to the next. In contrast, the National Security Advisor is usually quite close to the president. His natural habitat is the White House and the Situation Room in particular. His job is to work with various agencies, the Pentagon, the CIA, the State Department, and help the president sort through policy options. So it's not a natural fit to do both jobs simultaneously. This is likely a temporary arrangement, and it does suggest Trump is putting a lot of trust in Rubio for now. One other note, the last time this happened was under President Nixon, when he put Henry Kissinger in both those roles. Rubio seems to have Kissinger beat. He has two other jobs as well, the acting head of USAID and the acting head of the National Archives.
Before the shakeup, it seemed that the Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, might be the cabinet member most likely to lose his job. Does Secretary Hegseth seem safe for now?
Well, given Trump's unpredictability, nothing is certain, but Hegseth looks to be safe for the moment. He's still facing a lot of criticism. His hand-picked advisors have been dismissed, so it seems there's still some turmoil at the Pentagon. And as you noted, Scott, there's unprecedented churn in Trump's national security team in his first term. He had four separate national security advisors. The first one, Mike Flynn, lasted less than a month. He also had four defense secretaries and four directors of national intelligence.
Of course, all of this is occurring at a moment when there are a number of conflicts and challenges abroad. Bring us up to date.
So Trump still wants a ceasefire in the Russia-Ukraine war. That's proving elusive. He's been more supportive of Russia in general. But this week, the U.S. signed an agreement with Ukraine on natural resources. So this may keep Trump a bit more engaged with Ukraine. Trump came into office just as the Israel-Hamas truce was taking effect. That's now collapsed. The war in Gaza grinds on amid a major humanitarian crisis. And today marks 7 weeks since the U.S. launched a bombing campaign against the Houthis in Yemen. And we're still getting minimal information. We do know the U.S. has lost at least a half dozen drones at $30 million apiece, and a jet fighter, which cost more than $60 million, fell off the deck of an aircraft carrier this week and sank in the Red Sea.
NPR's Greg Myrie, thanks so much.
Sure thing, Scott.
And now it's time for sports. NBA playoffs, the East, as predicted, the West, not so much. Game 7 tonight, and a truly great coach retires. Howard Bryant of Meadowlark Media joins us. Howard, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. First round of the NBA playoffs. Rockets beat Golden State Warriors last night, 115-107. Force a Game 7 tomorrow. Tonight, another Game 7. This one between the Denver Nuggets and the Los Angeles Clippers. Both teams finished with exactly the same regular season record, but come on now. Only one team has Jokic, right?
True, true, but another team has Kawhi Leonard, who has two championships, one with the San Antonio Spurs and the other one with Toronto back in 2019. This has been a great series, and this is the one that everybody thought was going to be terrific because they are really evenly matched, and the Clippers suddenly have been a really, really good team after surviving all the injuries. And boy, what a joy it is to see Kawhi Leonard out on the court again, healthy. So much of what his career could have been, what it already has been, and it would have been even bigger without the injuries. But of course, there is Jokic. They are at home early in the series. Home court didn't really matter. The last couple games have been more lopsided. So I think you have to go with Denver as a favorite, but I am not a betting man, Scott Simon.
Yeah, all right. No particular surprise in the Eastern Conference because the top four seeds advanced in the first round. Cleveland rocks!
Cleveland awaits.
A classic rivalry in the second round.
Yeah, Knicks, Celtics, longtime rivals. I would be remiss before we got into that to not forget the fact that we do have Game 7 on tomorrow with Houston and Golden State. Will Golden State blow a 3-1 lead? Remember, they were up 3-1 in that series, and now we've got a winner-take-all in Houston. But as for the Celtics, they are the defending champions. They are the team that's kind of rounded into it. They're one of those teams that you're asking, along with Cleveland and along with Oklahoma City, do you see anybody beating them four times? The Knicks played them four times this season and lost all four. So on the one hand, we haven't seen the Knicks beat the Celtics this year at all, never mind four times. But on the other hand, it's also very, very difficult to beat a team eight times in a season. So we'll see what kind of adjustments the Knicks can make. And it was a great series. The Knicks and the Pistons put on a great show, and Jalen Brunson is just a superstar. This has been a really, really good playoff.
I want to ask you about Greg Popovich, finally. The longtime coach of the San Antonio Spurs announced his retirement. He'll stay with the Spurs as an executive. He's 76. He's been on indefinite leave while recovering from a stroke in November. He's coached the Spurs for 29 years. He won 5 NBA championships. He will be remembered for his life, not just on the court, won't he?
No, he'll be remembered for plenty, Pop, and he's still with us. And so we love Pop, and he's such a phenomenal influence on the game. When you watch the international game, you think about Pop. When you look at USA basketball, you think about Pop. When you look at the way the game is played in terms of the combination of defense and passing and yes, three-pointers, Greg Popovich was an incredible innovator in his ability to sort of navigate all of those things. But the thing that I love most about Pop is his willingness to still be a citizen. Most of these players and most of these coaches, they're in this super billion-dollar bubble. And Greg Popovich still talked about the world. He still was engaged with the world. He still talked about, you know, the issues that he thought were important to him, even though those topics could usually get you in trouble. But I was so happy to see that he was always willing to engage. He's going to be missed on the sidelines for being so curmudgeonly as well. But hopefully his recovery will be quick enough so we still get to see him. What a figure.
Yeah. Howard Brand of Meadowlark Media, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Scott.
Vietnam has been transformed since the end of what people there call the War of Resistance against America, and what Americans call the war in Vietnam. Life expectancy has soared, poverty has plummeted, economic opportunities abound. NPR's John Ruwitch visited and spoke with young people there. They reflect the generational changes that have come with development in the half century since the war ended.
Bui Ngoc Cam Phung is a 19-year-old college student in Ho Chi Minh City, formerly known as Saigon. On the side, though, she has a budding music career.
I like to do like experimental rap.
She goes by CP, her initials.
My lyrics is all about what I'm thinking as a young people, as a young adult in Ho Chi Minh City, Saigon.
Chaos permeates her music, like the city she lives in, she says, and some teen angst.
And I got so many tasks in mind as a young people. What should I do? Many choices in life, and that's all I write about.
Youthful rebellion is nothing new, of course. But that question, what should I do, is one that more and more young people in her generation are able to ask. CP says her grandparents were swept up in the war. They didn't have a choice. And her parents came to the big city, like many, at a time when Vietnam was clawing its way out of poverty.
I feel like our generation, like, we do not have an exact route to follow. Like, we can do whatever we want. If we have enough resources.
The hard part is figuring out what she wants, though.
Do I want the success of being famous and being a star? Or should I be a smart student and work in the literature field?
Whatever path she takes, CP says laziness isn't an option.
Yes, because our country is still developing.
I heard that same sense of responsibility, that patriotism, in a back alley in Hanoi, the capital, where I grabbed coffee with the man behind one of Vietnam's best-known Facebook pages. He's 32, and he doesn't want me to divulge his name because what he publishes is sometimes controversial. And he doesn't want to jeopardize his day job in software. The page is called Tifosi. It's Italian for passionate fan, as in a soccer fanatic. There are lots in Vietnam. In fact, he started out posting about soccer. His page took off, though, when he shifted to politics, society, and history. He says it's a passion, a hobby.
I want to write content that is positive and that can cheer on and motivate people.
His stuff often aligns with the government and can be ultra-nationalistic. In one article, Tifosi supported the right to eat dog meat because it's a tradition here. In another, he criticized what he saw as fawning reverence by a Vietnamese singer to Queen Elizabeth after her death in 2022. In the past, some of Vietnam's more notable blogs were critical of the authorities. Many bloggers have been silenced or jailed in a rolling crackdown. The man behind Tifosi says different opinions are fine, but there are limits.
Freedom of speech doesn't mean you can fabricate things. It doesn't mean things can be distorted. There's freedom of speech, but you have to say the right things. You have to be accurate.
Tifosi, he says, reflects something real in his world.
My friends, family, coworkers, everyone has a pretty positive view of the state.
That may be widespread, but it's hard to gauge. The authorities are becoming adept at guiding public opinion online and snuffing out criticism. Tifosi's creator says the police and security agencies think he's a positive force. Many others clearly do too. The page has more than 300,000 followers and counting. John Ruwitch, NPR News, Hanoi.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. There's a trend taking flight across America right now. Well, taking flight again.
My porch goose is on my front porch. It's white, it has a green base, it has a little yellow beak.
That's Stephanie Zawada of Western Springs, Illinois. She's one of a growing flock of people with life-size statues of geese, often cast of concrete, on their porch or in their garden. Porch geese aren't new. They've graced stoops for decades, but Sawada's is new. Hers is plastic. She got it online a few months ago and hasn't decided on a name yet because she's been busy styling it.
I ordered a cute little gardening outfit for it, so it's wearing a pair of overalls and a striped shirt and a little straw hat, and then it's holding a trowel and a flower pot in the other hand. And my neighbor, who has a porch goose as well, graciously gifted me a few outfits. A pumpkin for Halloween, a Hawaiian shirt with a lei and a straw hat, and then my favorite, it's a red polka dot bikini two-piece with red heart-shaped sunglasses.
She's hoping her goose turns heads this summer.
I want my neighbors to walk past my house and be like, oh, her flowers are so pretty and her goose's outfit is so cute and funny. You know, just a fun neighborly thing to do.
With how the economy's been trending and how politics have been trending, it seems that people are wanting to just have a bit of whimsy in their lives, and it seems like the porch geese is kind of addressing that issue.
Jeremiah Hines works at Harper's Statuary and Water Gardens in Rockingham County, Virginia, where porch geese are flying off the shelves.
Used to be at one time, like, we were lucky if we even sold 10 porch geese in the calendar year. Last year alone, we sold approximately 40 in 1 year, and then this year we've already surpassed selling 40 of them.
Stores are definitely selling more porch geese, both smaller local stores and some major retailers are getting in on the action too.
Kate Morgan is on the goose beat. For a recent piece in the Washington Post, she delved into dedicated social media groups that have as many as 250,000 members.
There is an entire economy surrounding porch geese and porch goose attire. Within these social media groups, there are lots of people who are making different outfits and taking custom orders, and everyone from middle-aged women to college students who are trying to pay their tuition by selling clothes for geese.
Kate Morgan says nostalgic millennials are the wind beneath the wings of the current porch geese craze.
They recall their grandmothers and their aunts dressing up their porch geese in the 80s and 90s. And in some cases, you know, there are some porch geese from even further back than that.
But why a goose in the first place?
Geese do not back down from a fight, as anyone who's ever tried to walk past a nesting goose in a park can probably attest. Pliny the Elder writes about a flock of geese that saved ancient Rome. The Gauls were attacking in the middle of the night and they were being really sneaky, but turns out you can't sneak up on a goose. And this flock of goose honked and shrieked and the Romans woke up and protected the city.
Live in an apartment or just don't have a porch? Well, some stores sell desk geese. You can dress up, maybe as BJ Lederman, who does our theme music.
It's an outward symbol of who you are, and it makes people smile.
And maybe in 40 years, we'll all smile at a resurgence of live, laugh, love signs. This is NPR News.
American ports are bracing for President Trump's tariffs. We'll look at what it means when the number of cargo ships arriving starts to dwindle. Plus, are you sure you're taking your pain medications the right way? We'll tell you what you need to know. Those stories, plus books, movies, music, and of course, the puzzle, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. The medical charity Doctors Without Borders says one of its hospitals was hit by an airstrike in a remote part of South Sudan. Officials told the Associated Press at least seven people were killed. A 25% U.S. tariff on imported auto parts went into effect today. It's expected to raise car prices and cut profits for automakers. And people who live near the SpaceX rocket facility in Texas are voting today on whether the area should be its own city. Elon Musk wants to incorporate it as the new city of Starbase. The measure is likely to pass, as most of the people eligible to vote work for SpaceX. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. And from Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at ProgressiveCommercial.com. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. More Americans with mental health needs have been getting talk therapy in recent years. It's according to a new study published in the American Journal of Psychiatry. And as NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports, it is the first time in decades that outpatient talk therapy has played a bigger role in mental health treatment than medications.
For many years, since the late 1990s, the use of psychotherapy or talk therapy declined and then plateaued. But that trend changed between 2018 and 2021. The new study finds that the number of American adults getting outpatient talk therapy grew from 6.5% to 8.5%.
So that's an increase from about 16.5 million to nearly 22 million people.
Dr. Mark Olson is a psychiatrist and epidemiologist at Columbia University and an author of the new study. While a majority of people getting therapy also use psychiatric medication like antidepressants and antipsychotic meds, the study also found that for the first time in decades, fewer people relied only on medication.
What we'd seen going all the way back to like the late 1980s, when Prozac first came on the scene and the other antidepressants like it, the SSRIs followed, medications have assumed a more and more important role. Here, for the first time in many years, we're seeing that flip.
In fact, Olson says more people are getting a combination of medication and talk therapy. And when people start talk therapy, he says, they're more likely to stick to it.
One of the problems historically has been that sometimes people show up for one visit and then they'll drop out prematurely.
But in recent years, says Dr. Jesse Gold, people are more aware about what to expect from therapy. Gold is a psychiatrist and chief wellness officer at the University of Tennessee.
So if we see an increase in talk therapy because people feel like they have things they want to talk about or could use the help or help seeking's more normalized, I think that's a great thing. And it might be in part what you're seeing.
That's in addition to wider access to talk therapy through telehealth since the COVID-19 pandemic.
Telehealth did increase access for people who might not have had any access to a therapist in their particular location or times.
Despite the growing access to talk therapy documented in the new study, the most recent data from a national survey shows that only about half of Americans with any mental illness received any treatment in the year before. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
Before the Silk Road, there was India's Golden Road, says historian William Dalrymple. It was a route that ran from the Roman Empire in the west to Korea and Japan in the Far East, enriching the world with spices, gems, oils, ivory, language, goods, literature, science, and people, faiths, and ideas that changed the world. His new book is The Golden Road, How Ancient India Transformed the World. And William Dalrymple joins us now from Houston on his U.S. book tour. Thanks so much for being with us.
A great pleasure, Scott. Thank you for having me on.
You call India a crucial economic fulcrum and civilizational empire. How did it influence the world? Or maybe I should say, where do we begin telling how it influenced the world?
Well, most obviously in its philosophies and ideas. Over half the world today lives in places that once were or are now strongly influenced by ideas that came out of India, ideas like Buddhism and Hinduism. But more universally, and I think people don't realize this, India is also the source of the number system we all use. In the West, we call it Arabic numbers because the West got it from the Arabs, but the Arabs got it from the Indians. Without it, we wouldn't have any of the higher mathematics that we all live on today. No algebra, no algorithms, no binary.
And the decimal system and zero, for that matter.
Exactly. And I think over the last 40 or 50 years, people have come to realize that how many of these ideas came to Europe from the Arab world. But I think people are still largely unaware in the West that all these things came originally from India.
What do you think has made many of us in the West unaware of India's contribution?
Well, I think the colonial phase of India's history, when the Victorian British ran down the subtlety and brilliance of Indian learning, people like Macaulay in the 19th century used to say that a single shelf of a good English library is worth all the native literature of India and Arabia. And although we laugh at those attitudes today, the import of those ideas still exists in our education system. Most of us, for example, will have learnt about Pythagoras or Archimedes in his bath shouting Eureka by our seventh or eighth birthday. But very few people will know, for example, that Aryabhatta came up with the exact circumference of the Earth, the distance from the Earth to the Moon, and the fact that the Earth is heliocentric, that we travel around the Sun. This was discovered in India 1,000 years before Galileo. And it's astonishing, really, that in the 21st century that so few people are aware of this.
How did India's central position kind of open it to the world centuries ago?
It's the meteorology, it's the winds. India, lying under Tibet, is the beneficiary of an extraordinary, unique wind system, which means that when Tibet freezes over in winter, the winds blow in, and when it thaws in summer, the winds blow out. And this means that uniquely in India, you have the monsoon winds which blow in one direction 6 months of the year, very fast, and then reverse themselves and blow back in again. So this is a kind of unique gift that means that India has always been the center of a maritime trading network, and why historically we've always had big Indian trading communities from the West Coast in places like East Africa and Aden and the Red Sea. And on the East Coast of India, you've had Tamil and other East Coast Bengalis in Singapore and in Burma.
Tell us about the Indian influence on faith and belief. Beginning with the birth of Buddhism.
Today, we often think of Buddhism as being a very otherworldly religion. And, you know, in Hollywood movies, Buddhist monks are sort of symbols of mysticism and intense spirituality. But early Buddhist monasteries were banks, which lent merchants money, where merchants would shelter. We have inscriptions from Indian sailors who report repaying the money lent to them by Buddhist monks and giving gifts to the monasteries as interest. So this extraordinary expansion of Buddhism, Buddha was a historical figure who lived in the mid-5th century BC in the Gangetic Plain on the banks of the Ganges, and his ideas spread out in about 500 years all over Asia. So there's this whole world which is totally transformed in every direction around India, and that's not true in reverse. You know, you don't find a Chinese philosophy taking over India, but you do find an Indian philosophy, Buddhism, taking over China and other Indian ideas of Hinduism, Sanskrit, taking over Southeast Asia. In fact, there's this whole world called, by some scholars, the Sanskrit Cosmopolis, where you have this Indian sacred language, Sanskrit, being used all the way from Afghanistan all the way to Bali in Indonesia, right through.
So let me ask you to tell us how you explored some of this thinking and this history. You didn't just look this up on the internet, did you?
I didn't. No, this was 5 years of work. I've traveled all over Southeast Asia, and this, I have to say, is stuff that specialist scholars know about. But in an odd way, it hasn't reached popular consciousness. I think it's time that changed. India is one of the world's most important civilizations. Within a few years, it'll be again the third biggest economy in the world. And it's time that we learned this stuff and gave it the honor and the centrality in human civilization that it holds. But we remain in the West very ignorant about it.
You posed the question toward the end of your book, has India's moment come once again? And you raise this question too, what sort of India will it be?
Well, that's the great question. I'm very optimistic economically about India, but who knows what sort of India we will see. I mean, India has now got a very authoritarian right-wing government. It doesn't always treat dissent with warmth, shall we say. And I think history shows that India is at its most creative when it is most open, when it is willing to receive and give ideas as well as put them out. And for that, we must remain hopeful.
William Dalrymple's new book, The Golden Road, How Ancient India Transformed the World. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. Great pleasure.
Jennifer Higdon is one of classical music's most performed living composers. She has more than 200 works and 3 Grammys to her name, and an opera currently in a world premiere run at the Pittsburgh Opera. It's called Woman with Eyes Closed. Higdon took an unconventional path to classical music, and she revealed some of the keys to her success in conversation with NPR's Tom Heisinger.
A key component in Higdon's success was her father, an artist, and Higdon says a radical thinker who gave her good advice.
You have to always question everything, and you don't have to follow the normal path.
If Higdon had followed that normal path, her music might have sounded something like this. Writing atonal music was encouraged in conservatories for decades, but it didn't click with Higdon.
For me, any kind of artist has to express whatever feels true to themselves.
For Higdon, that's melody, bold and sweet. You're pretty unapologetic about your music being described as accessible, and that's a word that many composers would not want associated with their music.
That's pretty funny. It doesn't bother me in the least because I think the whole point of what I'm doing, I'm writing to speak to people. So to me, accessible is an incredible compliment.
The piece of Higdon's that speaks most often, in fact it's been performed over 1,100 times since she wrote it, is called Blue Cathedral. Any idea why this piece has become your biggest hit?
I don't know if it's the slowness or the way it builds. I've never stopped to ask anyone because it's a hard question because it's so personal.
It's personal because Higdon lost her younger brother Andrew, whose middle name was Blue. Their relationship is embedded in Blue Cathedral, portrayed by the instruments they played, the flute for Higdon, the clarinet for her brother. They danced together, melodies intertwined. You were a latecomer to classical music. You grew up not really listening to that much classical music.
You're right. I didn't know a single Beethoven symphony at all when I went off to college. And I know there were probably professors who looked at me and said, what the heck is this kid doing? thinking she's going to be in classical music, but the thing was, I loved it.
Higdon was still unknown in 1998 when the Philadelphia Orchestra came calling for a commission. She responded with one of her finest pieces, a dazzling concerto for orchestra. It basically explodes right out of the gate with chimes and these busy figures in the strings, French horns, trombones, ping-ponging, timpani all over the place, this chattering winds, and it all surges to this huge climax within the first 57 seconds. How do you do that?
Too much adrenaline, too much Diet Coke.
It's amazing. It all works, and it's just really stunning.
You can feel the anxiety and the excitement. I knew that the second movement would be strings, so I thought I need a contrast of a lot of motion, and let's just show off the entire orchestra by having like a little tornado.
With music like that, who could doubt Higdon's prowess? Actually, she did. It took a Pulitzer Prize in 2010, when she was pushing 50, to convince her that her composing career was a real thing.
So many reporters were asking me after the Pulitzer, how did you get here? That I stopped and I went, whoa, how did I get here?
Did you run into any barriers because of your gender? I mean, because nearly every woman composer I've talked to has a story or two or three.
When my concerto for orchestra was performed, I was totally unknown then. And I can't believe how many men came up to me and said, I can't believe a woman wrote that.
Whoa.
And I know I heard that so many times. And my response was always, well, a woman did write it, so now you know.
These days, with prestigious awards behind her and a stack of commissions in front of her, Higdon commands respect. And she keeps churning out music. A dozen pieces per year is not uncommon for Higdon, even when they're as complex as Azure Waves, her recent string quartet. Looking back, Higdon is astonished at how she started, a wide-eyed high school flutist who eventually began writing music.
I felt like someone had given me the keys to a magic kingdom. And to be honest, I still feel that way to this day. I wake up in the morning, I think, oh my gosh, I get the right music today. It's just incredible joy that I have in my life.
And Higdon's joy in writing her accessible music is joy that continues to be admired by listeners far and wide. Tom Huizenga, NPR News.
You can read a longer interview with Jennifer Higdon at nprmusic.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. This is NPR.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.